Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Living free.
Thanks to Resident Frequency Radio for another great show. Welcome to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your AM dial and 3CR on digital radio. Hi, I'm Bill, and with my co-host Michael, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that this land was stolen and that sovereignty was never ceded. Each week on the Living Free Show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. Also, please note that Living Free Show may involve discussions of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. Please consider your well-being and that of others while listening. My guest today is an alcoholic who's recovering with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome Dan to the show. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dan, you're on the show early in 2024, so we'll concentrate more on the recovery side of your story. But would you like to give us some highlights of your drinking life before you found AA?
Sure, highlights. Yeah, what a question that is. I couldn't stop drinking, and it's only since I've been in recovery that I've realized that I don't think I ever wanted to stop drinking. Other people told me that I shouldn't drink so much, but that was never an option for me. I have done 40 or 50 rehabs and detoxes, and whilst I am eternally grateful to them for keeping me alive, they never educated me in what alcoholism was, and there wasn't one of those establishments that I didn't walk out and pick up a drink straight away. Yeah. It's very difficult for me to pick out highlights of my drinking because it was 27 years of this is my normality, and whatever the consequences of that drinking was, I was not going to stop. The times that I'm careful of my language, made a decision to try and stop, that was never going to last. Yeah. That was never going to last. And you know, it's it was so painful, and I didn't know that. That is part of the disease that we call alcoholism. That, you know, I've heard someone say recently, if you're a heavy drinker, you put the drink down and the problems go away. But if you're an alcoholic, you put the drink down and that's when the problems start. Yep. And I didn't know that. And highlights of my drinking, we'd be here all year.
Yeah.
But because like, yeah. Drinking was my life. Yep. It's what I had to do. I didn't know this, and you know, it's what I had to do in order to function.
Yeah. Was it a spectator sport, or was it something you did by yourself at home?
Oh, look, that changed over the years. I remember when I had my first drink, I think I was about 15 or 16, and you know, I share this quite frequently, but you know, if I sit here long enough, I can still feel what that feels like going in. And it was the reason, it felt like it was the reason I was here.
Yeah.
Everything changed that day that it went in, and I suddenly felt all right. And what I didn't realize was that that's not normal. And what I didn't realize was that meant that something was very wrong prior to me putting in that drink. Yeah. And from that moment in time, it became my solution. And you just asked, was it a spectator sport? If you could stick around long enough, But what happened from that moment in time is that life got in the way of my drinking. Because from that moment onwards, whether I was drinking or not drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And, you know, props to those that stuck around long enough. I don't know if I could have, but, you know, it's all I thought about.
Mm. Do you, looking back, do you understand why you drank?
Why I drank?
Yeah. Why you needed to drink?
Well, I can give you a very AA-related answer to that, but yeah. I drank because I'm an alcoholic with an untreated condition.
Yeah, but did you feel a need to drink before you drank?
No.
No.
No. But what I did know was that, oh no, careful with my words. What felt normal to me, I didn't know wasn't normal. So once I had that drink, I felt better, which meant that before drinking, I didn't feel good.
Yeah.
You know, I felt lonely. I felt isolated. I felt scared. Serious overthinking going on and feelings of not being good enough and some impending doom, something's going to go wrong. And I didn't know that wasn't a normal way to think and feel.
Mm. Yeah. So that was my question about, yeah. So the reason you were looking for a solution, you didn't know you had a problem.
No.
But you were looking for a solution to that problem that you didn't know you had. Yeah.
Yes. To me, that was my reality.
Yeah.
Life was a struggle. That's what I thought life was all about. And to this insecure, anxious young person, I looked around at all the people around me and judged myself very, very harshly against them because I couldn't seem to do life as they were doing it. Mm. And I will have a drink, you know, and there we go.
Yeah. So when you first went to rehab, did you want to stop drinking or did you just want to be able to control it?
No, I certainly didn't want to stop drinking.
Yeah.
Because the thought of not having a drink was too painful. Like as I alluded to just there, I didn't know I had a problem, so I didn't know that there was a solution. For me, going into these rehabs and detoxes was simply a way of getting back on track and getting a bit stronger physically and emotionally and mentally in order to try to do life in a different way and to be able to control my drinking. I certainly didn't know that it was possible to live a life sober and to be happy about it. Mm. That wasn't my experience.
Yeah. Not on your radar.
No. In fact, yeah. I fought very hard against those that said you can't have a drink. You're one of those people that shouldn't drink. Yeah. No, not me, because you know I need to drink until the unacceptable becomes acceptable. Because without a drink or a solution to a problem that I don't know I have, I can't do it, Bill.
Yeah.
I would have done it if I could.
Yeah, can't do it alone. Yep. So why did you go to your first rehab?
Oh,
can you remember?
I can remember, you know, I don't want to get too morbid about this, but my mother had been diagnosed with cancer and she didn't have long to live and I was already excessively drinking and always had been. You know, but it got worse. And my wife at the time could see it was getting worse. And then my mum passed away and it got even worse. So, you know, I woke up one morning and it could have been the morning, could have been night, could have been any time. But I woke up at one point and my wife at the time said, look, I've booked you into this rehab. And... yeah, that was that.
Yeah.
I didn't have any agency on whether I was going to rehab or not.
Yeah.
How old were you then?
I think I was 26, 27. Don't quote me on that though.
But you're married.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad was an alcoholic, and I remember when his father died, and that was a major drinking time for him. He was just devastated when his mm-hmm. father died. And I think alcoholics and any addict are very sensitive people, and they feel things very strongly.
Sure.
So did you have that experience in your life that you sort of felt life intensely?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Everything that you do is about me.
Yeah.
every reaction, every thought, every feeling that you have is an attack or a criticism on me personally.
Yeah.
And again, that's not something that I was aware of.
No. And you're doing plenty of things that will upset people.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
So I have to. I have to.
Yeah.
I have to. I didn't realize that, you know, without a solution, I create my own reality anyway. And you know, going back to my mum passing away, you know, and when I do the work with my sponsor, and she was the first one on my resentment list, because how dare she pass away when I needed her, you know, and at no point during her illness, you know, I went on what can only be termed a death watch as she was getting iller and iller. But I was not able to be considerate or present to the fact that she was the one that was dying. I was terrified of what I would do without her.
Yeah, and grieving, yeah.
And my solution to the inevitability of my mum not being around was to get drunk. At no point in her illness did I ask her if she was okay. And then she passed away, and wow, I need to drink even more to numb those feelings and those sensitivities.
So did you feel guilty about not being there for your mum?
Of course, but the drink took that away.
Yeah.
Of course. And you know, I was in that first rehab. I don't want this to sound all a self-piteous thing, but it's important, you know. I was in that first rehab, and I was 2 weeks into what can only be described as white-knuckling it, you know, and my father passed away. And I got that news, and you know, in the interest of being honest, I was happy because it meant that I could get away. I was obviously upset.
Yes.
But it meant that I had an excuse to get out and go and drink, and that's all I was looking for. Because you know, the rehab was not able to offer me the solution to the problem that I didn't know I had.
So what did your wife and family think when you got out? Did they think things were going to change by that brief interlude?
I can't answer that question. I don't know. I can only speculate as to maybe they felt some sort of hope.
Yeah.
But I know that nothing that I had heard within that institution was going to help me live life on life's terms.
Mm. Yeah. So you mentioned that you've been in many other rehabs and detoxes. So I guess if we skip to the last one, why did you go to the last one, and did it work for you?
Why did I go to the last one?
Yeah.
And again,
were you pushed?
I was left in a very difficult situation. I was homeless when I finally ended up at, you know, this last one. But I did it in order to fix the relationship with my partner at the time, and to be able to, in order to go back into the family home, and that's the only reason I did it. I didn't do it to stop my drinking. I did it in order to go home. Because again, you know, the consequences kept getting worse and worse and worse. But God forbid you take away my alcohol. And going into that rehab was just, or detox, sorry, was just a demonstration of my willingness to accept that I'd done something wrong. Now let me back.
Yep. Okay.
But I still didn't believe that it was possible to go to do life without alcohol.
Yeah.
I was still, sorry to interrupt, I was still thinking of ways in which I could manage the situation.
Manipulate, So, so what happened? What changed the last time?
In terms of why I went into,
why did it work on you?
Why did it work?
Yeah.
I didn't get what I wanted. I did not get back to go back into the family home. I was homeless and I was left with no choice in terms of, look, I was booked into this dayhab program and they suggested doing AA. And it had been the only thing that I had never tried. And I was still trying to convince my ex-partner that I should be allowed home. So I thought, I'll give that a go. And that's the only reason. Again, not to stop drinking.
Yep.
To prove that I was willing to accept some sort of responsibility for having caused harm. But, you know, yeah. I didn't go to AA through choice.
So why did it work this time or that time? What changed?
I have changed. I was introduced to what alcoholism was.
So knowledge.
Knowledge. Yeah. And for the first time in my life, I felt understood. And I had people at meetings nodding their head going, yep, we know.
Yep, been there, yep.
And, you know, I've done some bad things and they're not necessarily things that I would have wanted to have done or should have done. But, you know, these people looked at me and as I said, they said, I know. You don't have to be like, I remember hearing the words, we're not bad people trying to get good, we're sick people learning to be well.
Yeah.
And they had a smile on their face and they seemed to be happy with their lives and that annoyed me. And they said, if you want what we've got, you do what we do. And I think I had given up giving up. And, you know, I still had that agenda of getting back into the family home. So I thought, I'll give this a go.
And it worked
to this day.
Yeah. Okay, we might take a short break.
I'm lucky and I'm clever. It's time again for Dumb By Law's legendary annual trivia night. We know you've been waiting, and yes, it is here. Grab some teammates and come along to catch up with like-minded folks in the community legal sector and beyond, and try your luck at taking home trivia glory. We're raising much-needed funds for the incredible 3CR. 3CR is 100% community controlled and relies on annual fundraising to keep its amazing local content on air. Friday 24th of October, 6:30 p.m. at the Richmond Town Hall. Tickets available via 3cr.org.au/dumbbylaw.
What we're dealing with here is a total lack of respect for the law.
Tune in to Done By Law.
An informal and irreverent look at the law. Critical insights and analysis from diverse community perspectives.
Done By Law, 6 p.m. Tuesdays.
Ah, this is the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio. 855 kHz on your AM dial and 3CR on digital radio. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just Google 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us via phone or email. Today I'm talking with Dan and we're talking about alcoholism and recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. So Dan, before the break we were talking about getting into recovery, finding AA, and your life changing when you realised that there were other people who had the same problem, same outlook as you. So what were the early things in AA that helped you, I guess, come to grips with your situation and start navigating your way out of it?
Oh, goodness. Again. I couldn't deny that clearly something was working, and it's you know, like I said before the break, that connection and not being judged. You know, it wasn't about getting up and revealing my deepest, darkest secrets, but it was about recognizing that I was told, you're not here because your life's going well, Daniel.
Yeah.
You know, and I, for the first time in my life, I could say, I can't stop drinking. And quite frankly, I don't even think that I want to. And the shame was lifted on that secret for me. Mm. You know, again, that those words were so powerful. You're not bad trying to get good. You're sick learning to be well. And as I got more vulnerable, you know, with people that I respected and who seemed to genuinely care without agenda, I was able to see, you know, I don't know, see that it might work for me.
Yeah.
You know, one of the greatest gifts I got in recovery, in early recovery, is I don't know where it came from, but I suddenly was able to listen. And, you know, as I said before, the evidence is in the rooms. These people nod their head and don't judge, and they go, yep, yep. In fact, a lot of the times they seem quite bored.
Yeah.
about yeah, we've done that too.
Yeah.
You know, and we were just talking in the break about some of the madness that goes through our heads, you know. Normal drinkers don't think about controlling their drinking. Mm. And I heard things like, you know, blackout drinking isn't normal. And to me they were. You know, and I heard people getting vulnerable and saying that they used to be scared at the thought of running out of drink. And I'm like, yeah, I know that feeling. Mm. And I heard people say that, you know, sometimes they don't even need to put the drink in them to feel better. They just need to know it's there. And I went, wow, that's me. And, you know, we were just, again, laughing in the break. Day drinking. When I found out you could drink during the day, my life changed.
Yeah. When it was okay to drink during the day.
You know? And you know, obviously it didn't start out like this, but, you know, when I had that first night out on a Wednesday, and I'm not struggling from Saturday through to Friday, I can break it up with a Wednesday. Wow, that's great. You know, and they say in the rooms, look for the similarities, not the differences. And we laughed. You know, we laughed at the hiding the recycling, fearing the bin man and hearing the clinks in the garbage thing. You know, all this isn't normal to a non-alcoholic, but to me it's absolutely normal.
Yep.
And you know, then waiting for my partner to fall asleep so I can go and get a drink, and the fear of you know, the noise, oh god, you're so loud when you're trying to be silent.
Yeah.
and they described it and they made it normal. And I'd never been able to disclose any of that before. Mm. And they pointed out things to me that I didn't even know that I was doing were not normal, because it had just been my normality. You know, if I go back to when we were talking about that first drink in the first bit, you know, the last thing that, you know, a child who felt like I did, who was anxious and scared and so fearful is going to do is actually put their hand up and go, I feel different.
Yeah. Don't draw attention.
No. Lonely, but I'm not asking for help. No. You know, and the other thing that was that I heard in the rooms is, you know, you can feel lonely in a crowded room. And all of this made sense to me. These were some of the reasons that I drank, because I do feel uncomfortable in my own skin, but there's no way I'm letting you know that I do. You might judge me. You might say that I'm not good enough. You might make me feel worse about myself than I already did. Yeah. And, you know, very gently and in a very loving and patient way, people spoke to me and just made me feel comfortable and safe. And, you know, the evidence was there. It had to be pointed out to me by someone. The evidence was there that my way wasn't working.
Yeah.
But it had to be pointed out to me. But it had to be pointed out to me by people that had been there and done that. All my life, people had been telling me, just don't drink. Or, you know, and I'm like, don't you think I've tried that? Or that, you know, I go to the doctor and he says one more drink might kill you. And this happened. He said, if you have another drink, you might die. And my thinking goes, I need a drink to cope with that news.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have words to explain how I felt. And what the people in AA gave me is the words to explain how I felt, because they had felt it too. But not only that, they offered a solution to not feeling like that anymore. And, you know, the evidence was there in the room again. I couldn't deny that it worked. For me, you know, I got introduced to people with 3 years sobriety, 4 years, 5 years, 20 years. None of that is a conceivable thought for me, because when I came into the room, I couldn't go 45 minutes without drinking. Let alone 45 years. It doesn't make sense. I when I put that drink into me for the first time, that's what I was here for. That's what I need. And you know, they've shown me how to do it. They've shown me how to live a life that I love today. And I didn't think that was possible for someone like me. I didn't know what alcoholism was. They showed me what alcoholism was. They taught me about alcoholism, but they did it in a very gentle way, as I said. And that's what I needed. And yeah, my life's changed.
Yeah, that's good. Awesome. We'll take another short break.
On Sunday the 19th of October, Be True Geelong will be hosting a rally to stand against hate and racism at Transvaal Square from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Come along and listen to community leaders and First Nation elders and join us for a march and yarning circle. After that, join us at 6 p.m. at the Geelong Platform Arts for our second screening of Our Warrior, the story of Robbie Thorpe. Follow us on Facebook at Be True Geelong for more information. Be True Geelong is a proud 3CR supporter. MC
Mooks, Black Folly Entertainment.
Tune in to Billabong Beats Tuesdays at 11 a.m. with me, Gavin Moore, giving a voice to both Western Kulin and Kulin First Nations peoples. Join me to talk about philosophy and dreamtime stories surrounding the waterhole, the sacred fire, the land, the plants and animals. Billabong Beats, 11 a.m. Tuesdays on 3CR.
Sorry. This is the Living Free Show on 3CR Digital Radio, live streaming on 3cr.org.au. And we're talking with Dan, and we're talking about alcoholism and recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. So, Dan, before the break, we were talking about getting into AA and, you know, feeling familiar and accepted in the AA family. So, usually when you get involved in recovery, you get involved. you're a participant, then you're a contributor. So what's life like for you in AA today?
Busy, but in a good way. And it's, you know, one of the lines in the book is, it says, you will live a life beyond your wildest dreams. And my life today is certainly beyond my wildest dreams. And that has changed over time. You know, from putting my head on the pillow sober was not something that I could conceivably dream of. Wanting to put my head on the pillow sober is not something that I could think of or dream of. And today I get to enjoy it on a daily basis. And that, you know, the gifts that come from that, it keeps on giving. And what I got told in an early recovery is that you give it away to keep it. And, you know, to someone like me, that doesn't make any sense, because I have fought for everything in my life, and clearly it didn't work, which is why I ended up in AA. You know, my life is, I couldn't, if you'd have sat me down 4.5 years ago and said, this is what your life will be, I wouldn't have believed you. All I have done is simply listen to those who have gone before me, and as I said earlier, had what I wanted. And I don't mean in terms of the car and the money and the status and all that, because I had all that, and it wasn't enough. I still couldn't and wouldn't stop drinking. What they had was an air of peace about them, and a contentment and an ability to be satisfied with life. And I had no idea what that was. And, you know, they gave me a few simple instructions to do. And at the beginning, it was get to as many meetings as you can. Get some phone numbers. Share if you're asked to share. And, you know, simple things like that. And I found that, you know, one day led into two into three, and 4.5 years down the line, obviously my involvement with the program has got more and more. Not because I want more and more, but it makes me happy to be involved in it. Mm. And, you know, I, as I said at the beginning of this, I've changed in recovery, and that's good, because the way I was wasn't working. You know, I get to share my experience, strength and hope on a daily basis with those that want to listen. And, you know, I know what it's like out there. Mm. And my, you know, deepest, darkest secrets have become my greatest asset and tool, because I also know what it's like to suffer, and I don't. No one deserves to feel that way. Mm. And I get to use my experience in order to help someone potentially feel a bit better about themselves. And I get to see that on a daily basis. And, you know, for someone like me that was absolutely gripped by self-centered fear, we call it, you know, and only concerned about what I could get, being able to give because it's the right thing to do feels wonderful. You know, seeing people get well is wonderful. And I am not the kind of human being that feels happy to see someone else happy. No. I get quite resentful and jealous and go, well, why am I not happy? Yeah. But as I said, I got told, you got to give it away to keep it. And, you know, the bright spark of my life is watching someone go, oh my God, I didn't know. I've heard you say those words time and time again, but now I understand what you're saying. Yeah. To watch the, you know, whatever, that awareness grow and go, oh my, because that's life changing.
Yeah. Yeah. The fog clears. Yeah.
It's life changing. And I get to do that all the time. I work with sponsees. I go to regular frequent meetings. I chair meetings. I do stuff like this. This, you know, I guest speak at meetings, and for this, you know, insecure, anxious little boy inside this 47-year-old body, yes. You know, I'm forever grateful, and it's, you know, we talk of high ego and low self-esteem in the rooms, and I know that, you know, might not make sense to everyone. I certainly didn't. I didn't understand any of what AA was saying. Mm. You know, I didn't realize I had no self-esteem. But I now know what it's like to have self-esteem and to feel genuinely okay with myself and feel better about myself and feel worthy and all those cringy words that you hear when you first come in the rooms and go, what are you on about? I understand it now. And to be able to share that experience with others is a gift. So, yeah, my life's very, very different.
Yeah. Michael, over to you. So I know you sponsor people too. So do you want to talk a bit about sponsorship and how important that is in AA?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I've so I think that the what the program is showing me is that I have no control over whether someone drinks or someone doesn't drink. But my ego tells me that I'm the person who's going to teach him not to drink, and I'll show them. And that's the temptation with sponsorship, is that I'm going to teach them something. And actually, I have no right to teach anybody anything, because if the alcoholics are like me, they're not listening. And they're going to have their own experience. They're going to go and do their own thing. But so what happens and how it works is that usually someone, it's like internet dating. It's so awkward to ask for help. Yeah. Like you come into AA and you go, oh, the last thing, you know, the heaviest thing in the world is your phone. And picking up the phone and making a call is really difficult. But then asking someone to guide you. And my experience was that in the first 18 months of coming to AA, I burnt my life to the ground trying to run my own life sober. And so I, out of a complete desperation, I had to ask for help. And then take the direction, because not because I'm a good bloke, but because I had no other choice. My sponsor calls it a flamethrower at my ass decision. Yeah. And then what happens is that person then just shows me what they did, and they're not trying to teach me, and they're just trying to show me what they did, and they promise me if I do what's outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is what Alcoholics Anonymous is named after, the program's named after the book. And the book's a textbook, and it gives some instructions about how to feel connected with other people and the actions. And they don't look like they should work. And that, you know, the action of thinking of others and doing things for other people doesn't look like it's going to fix this problem. So, and that's all that you do. You get asked to do it by somebody. They say they think that you're helping them. And actually what they're doing is they're going to – my experience with – Daniel and I went to a meeting recently, and I got asked to share on this topic. It was that when I'm dealing with newcomers in AA, that they are a force of nature, of self-will, of just, you know, they're not going to listen, they're going to do it. And what they do is they make me so uncomfortable that I have to look at what I'm doing, because the discomfort is mine. I don't even have consequences of what happened with their actions. And it keeps me sober, having to keep looking at my thinking and my behaviours around them. The same as, I was going to say about my workplace. Everywhere I go, I've got to practice this acceptance of other people being themselves. And sponsorship is just another thing about that. I actually have a close relationship, and people start to trust me. And we build a relationship through the sponsorship, because my experience of it is that I read the book with another person, and we read ourselves into the book as to suffer from the same problem, and then I'll be willing to make the decision to do the same solution. And so I feel connected to them, and that trust thing is amazing, because I haven't trusted anybody for so long. And then you have this moment of trust, and you go, oh my God, it's possible that I might trust somebody else. And that is life-changing. Actually, I didn't come here to trust someone else. I came here to not drink. Mm. And they go, and that's a crack in my armor. And sponsorship always does that for me. When I think I'm helping someone else, all I'm doing is giving them what was given to me for free. And then I get this chink in my armor and a chink in their armor, and we do it together. And you do it one-on-one with another person. It's in the language in the book Alcoholics Anonymous says that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with another alcoholic, yeah. That identification one-on-one. And yeah, and it's changed. It's, and it's the reason you do it. What I say to my sponsees is, we'll finish reading the book, and then your job is to go and read the book with someone else.
Yeah.
I'm just going to teach you how to read the book.
Yeah.
And then you'll read the book just, you know, with somebody else.
Yeah. Thank you. So Dan, about sponsorship then, Michael talked about, you know, the trust that you need to have with somebody you're sponsoring. So do you want to talk a bit about that, about that level of trust?
Yeah, like Michael has just said, you know, I didn't come here to trust someone. And what I have learned is that I don't trust people because I can't trust myself. If you thought like I thought, you know. And what I've learned is that, you know, it's only me that thinks like that. Well, not just me in the rooms, but it's only me that thinks I'm terminally unique in that sense. But it's, you know, to be able to bear my soul in terms of the things I think and the actions that I've taken and the feelings that I've felt, that I have just tried to bury and hide all my life, it's, and not be judged. Yeah, I'm using that word a lot today, judged. But, you know, we do, you know, step four and five, we go through our inventory with our sponsor. And you know, I went through that. And it's the first time in my life that I get vulnerable. And it's the first time in my life that I do something different by being vulnerable. And it's the first time in my life that I get an experience of someone going, that's okay. And I've never had that experience of it being okay to be me, because I've always hidden what I am, and I've hidden what I've done, and I've hidden what I've thought for fear of being rejected. And I've never let anyone in, God forbid. And you know, I get to do that. I've obviously done it with, you know, my sponsor, and I get to do it with when I do the process with sponsees. As Michael has said, you build up that relationship, because we just look at each other and go, yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy. And you know, all my life I have tried to arrange or manage or make people, places and things do, behave and act how I think they should. And what I've learned in recovery is that I'm powerless over people, places and things, and it's my job to you know, fit in, and it's okay. And when I have that relationship forming with a sponsor or a sponsee, what they can do is then call me out, or I can call them out on behaviors that are keeping me unwell, because I trust them, and their input into to my behavior is not a personal attack, as I would take it when I'm untreated. What it is an act of love to go, no, you're causing the problem here, do something different and you'll stop getting hurt, because you can keep banging your head against that brick wall, but people are not going to change, and it's not going to change the situation, and if you did something different, you might be less upset. And that's amazing.
Who would have thought?
Who knew? I'm going to do it my way again and get the same result.
Now, before you mentioned terminally unique, which is quite interesting, because we're all unique, but the concept of terminally unique is that we're so unique that there's no one else like us. And coming into AA, you found there was a lot of people like you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Or I'm not going to die because of my unique way of feeling and seeing the world. That's how I interpret it some ways.
Okay.
And beforehand, I was going to die because I'm terminally unique, because no one else has felt how I felt. No one.
And no one can help you. Yeah.
Well, no one can help me because I don't trust anyone, and I'm not going to tell them for fear that they might reject me, you see.
It's a circle, yeah.
See, well, I won't tell you anything about me, but then I'm going to be different from all you, because I'm not accepting the fact that this is what it's like.
Okay. You said you'd been in AA 4.5 years. So has your relationships changed based on the fact that you're in AA?
my relationships.
Yeah.
No, I've changed.
Yeah.
I've changed. I keep saying this at the moment in meetings. If I don't change, my sobriety date will.
Right.
Because as I said, all my life I tried to you know, there's a bit in the book we talk about the director. I've tried to direct people how I think they should behave. Mm. I've tried to force things in order to be how I want, how I would have you behave, how I think you should be doing this. And I'm right. But I'm not, because I walk into to AA and my life is absolutely out of control. And my thinking is unmanageable. Mm. But I still think I'm right. You know, what I've learned in AA is that I have very little power over people, places and things. And it's my, you know, it's nice not trying to. We were talking about it before we did this, you know. It's up to me to allow people the dignity of their own experience.
Mm.
You know, I have no idea what's going on for other people. And that's good. That's good. Mm. I can ask them. Yeah. I can ask them and let them have their feelings, because when you know, when people tried to tell me what to do, it didn't work.
Dig the heels in.
Yeah. And, you know, I come into the rooms absolutely broken, thinking I know everything. The first thing that I have to do is go, I'm right, but I'm miserable.
Yeah.
And then I can go, hang on. Is it better to be well or is it better to be right? And then I can listen to people and I don't need to be right anymore. I can be open-minded and go, I don't know.
Okay. If anybody would like to find out more about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can phone them in Australia on 1300 222 222, or jump online at aa.org.au for more information on recovery and the available meetings. That's about all we've got time for today, so I'd like to thank Dan for sharing some more of his alcoholism recovery story with us and talking about how AA has helped him. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much.
I hope you'll be able to join us again next week when Michael will be talking with another guest about compulsion, addiction and recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. Coming up next, we've got Balanoir, The Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Talgum Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco and The Spirit of Wah on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.